Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Thanks, Marshall. Off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway, and New York Alternative Theater is what we're going to be talking about today on Off Script, and I'm delighted to have as my guest a theater professional and theater personality who's compiling an oral history of it, and that is off-Broadway, and I can't imagine anyone better qualified to do so. My guest is Casey Charles, founder of Primary Stages, arguably the most influential of off-Broadway theater, which under Casey's artistic direction, beginning in 1984, has launched many world premieres and plays by the likes of, are you ready, Horton Foote, Connor McPherson, Terrence McNally, A.R. Gurney, Atul Fugard, Romulus Linney, John Patrick Shanley, Charles Bush, and on and on and on. In 2016, Casey, after over 30 years, gave up the executive producership of Primary Stages, although he remains on its board of directors, and has turned his attention to Primary Stages' off-Broadway oral history project, which I'm going to talk about with him today. Welcome, Casey.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks for coming on. In your contribution to the project, which is posted on the Primary Stages website, I read that your youthful passion for theater was ignited in New York on a 1971 trip with a youth group from what you described, and I'm quoting now, as an aggressively progressive church in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and that among the first plays that you saw on those trips to New York were House of Blue Leaves. Now, for anybody who's seen House of Blue Leaves, I would say that's a pretty aggressively progressive church program to be sending kids from Michigan to New York to see. Was it not?
Well, I was lucky in growing up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and being a part of a church that was extremely liberal, extremely progressive. And their idea, and I think rather affluent, their idea was every year to send a troop of students to New York City. And we would go and we would see Broadway shows, mm-hmm. but we would also see off-Broadway. And I saw The Fabulous Miss Marie up at the new Harlem Arts Theater, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and House of Blue Leaves.
Yeah. And anyone who's seen the ending of House of Blue Leaves is a pretty progressive thing for a 16-year-old kid, or for any teenager from anywhere, I guess. So what was the first Broadway show you saw?
First Broadway show I saw with my parents before I started taking the trips, and that was Baker Street, directed by Hal Prince, mm-hmm. a musical about Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And the first theater, I gather you grew up in Michigan.
Grew up in Michigan, and my parents were involved in a wonderful civic theater. There was a great community life of civic theaters, circle of civic theaters there. And I started acting when I was, I think, 5 or 6 years old in the plays there. I was in All the Way Home with my mother, playing opposite my mother, when I was, I guess, 8 years old.
Yeah. So theater's not only in your blood, but you were really born into it.
Would you? Yes.
That's fair to say.
Yes, except my mother taught drama. My father was a lawyer, but he worked on the board, so he was on the business end of theater.
Okay. So you were destined to come to New York, pretty much.
I think so.
Yeah.
My first 2 years out of high school, I went to Los Angeles, University of Southern California, good school, drama department.
Mm-hmm.
Decided it was not quite the place for me. At that time, I was sort of crossing over with interest in film and television and theater. And then I transferred out of there after 2 years. I went to Carnegie Mellon University, which is a very good place to be if you're a theater major, and was there for 3 years as an actor and 2 years as a director.
Okay. So we're going to get to the oral history project, but let's jump ahead. You came to New York. You were with New Dramatists for a while.
Yes.
For a couple of years, I gather. And then in 1984, you formed Primary Stages. What was, I guess, not in a bad way, I'm going to just say the straw that broke the camel's back. What was the moment you said, okay, I've got to have a theater company of my own. I've got to found one that I can use to really express everything I feel and see about theater.
Going back just a little bit, yep. I took a job at the New Dramatists to meet playwrights as a stage manager. And the first thing that I did there was a play by Romulus Linney. And I thought, wow, if this is what new plays is and what it's like working with new playwrights, this is wonderful. Because until that time, I had pretty much had a lot of exposure in the theater to dead playwrights and felt very comfortable with dead mm-hmm. playwrights. And suddenly you're confronted with a live playwright and it's a whole new game. Through a series of circumstances, I ended up running the artistic program at the New Dramatists for 3 years. And at that time, people were more into doing readings of plays, new plays, mm-hmm. than productions of new plays. And I got the idea that many playwrights have got to see the play produced fully in order to really make the growth step as the playwright. So when we started Primary Stages, I thought that we're just going to produce all of these plays that I know are out there. We're going to get them up down and dirty. We're just going to get them up and we're going to do the best job we can, but we're about the long-term growth of a playwright, not any individual play. And we're going to make an investment in playwrights. So we've always been more about playwrights than we have about plays.
Let's give a shout-out for a minute to Romulus Linney, because Laura, Romulus's daughter, is well-known to her friends in Northwest Connecticut up here. So I'm curious, what was the first play of Romulus Linney that you did?
There were two plays, two one-acts, and it was Choir Practice was the name of the first one, and the second one was FM. FM, I still think, is one of the most perfect little one-acts ever written. And they were directed by Betty Osborne, and we're at the New Dramatists, so we're only doing readings of the plays,
right.
Very nicely produced readings of the plays, but readings of the plays. And Romulus is writing and rewriting and working on them every day. And we worked on it, I think, for about 2 weeks and then put it up for 4 performances.
Well, that's a lot of rehearsal for a reading.
Yes, but they're writing and reworking all
at the same time.
Yeah,
that's great.
So it's not just about getting the reading up. It's getting the
play
finished and polished as much as you can in a reading situation.
Great. In case you've just joining us, the program's Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. And my guest is Casey Childs, who's the founder of Primary Stages, one of the most influential in Off-Broadway, and who's now turning his attention and time to Primary Stages' Off-Broadway Oral History Project. So I don't want to make light of the 30-plus years and all the great, great playwrights that Primary Stages introduced to New York, but we do want to talk about the Oral History Project, right? And maybe we can reflect back on some of those at the same time. So where did the idea for the Oral History Project come from?
I saw that many people were not aware of our roots as a theater movement, and it was a very important theater movement. And many of the people who had been involved just post-World War II and pre-World War II were dying. And we have wonderful records of them, second and third hand, in interviews, magazines, and things. But I thought, we have the capacity now to get first-hand information from the person. And I had been on the board of the Directors Guild of America, and we had an oral history project there for television directors and for movie directors. And I thought, this is really quite easy to do. And I floated the idea by a few people, and they said, oh, no, it'll be thousands of dollars per interview, and you've got to do transcripts. I said, no, you don't really have to do any of that. You just have to have people who are interested and have the time to do it and the curiosity, and we can do it for free and raise a few dollars if we need to start doing a website, which eventually we did. And so we put it together from there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let me back up a little bit. When did the term Off-Broadway come into the lexicon of describing theater in New York or making a difference between what was being produced and shown in the Broadway area and what was happening
there
downtown and Provincetown Playhouse and all that?
Well, Off-Broadway's probably been around as long as Broadway has been around. The term for selling it, there's a few people who take credit for originating the term. Merle Dubusky, And his press office say basically they came up with the term off-Broadway because this was a good way.
And this would have been in the 40s, the 50s?
This would have been in the early 60s.
Oh.
When Joe Papp was just getting started. So
right.
This is a good way to differentiate Broadway from off-Broadway. We'll just call it off-Broadway. There was always an alternative or a non-commercial theater movement going on in New York City, but there was this was I guess that's when it started. We have had the good fortune of having a few people, not very many, but a few people that were pre-World War II, and there was a vibrant theater life going on in New York pre-World War II, but obviously most of the people that we have are post-World War II, in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s.
Right. Yeah. Right. So when you go back to things like the Provincetown Playhouse, mm-hmm. Are there any old-timers or any second-generation people?
From the Provincetown Playhouse yet.
Yeah.
And we haven't gone into really second-generation people.
Right.
As far back as we've gone, I think would probably be Five-ish Finkel, who passed away a few years ago. He was into his 90s when he died. He started his professional career in New York City at the age of 8, working in what was the Yiddish Theater, or the Second Avenue Yiddish Vaudeville. And he could give you a picture, he had a very sharp memory when he did the interview, he could give you a picture of what theater was in New York City, not commercial, pre-World War II. Which was kind of amazing.
Yeah. Is that what you want when you do an oral history interview? Do you want people to paint a picture? Do you want
Yes.
the memory to become alive? And I guess the question is, how do you structure your interviews in a way that might, in a uniform kind of way, or in a uniform approach, elicit the kind of information that you really want from an historical point of view?
You want them to talk. That's the important thing. And you want, and what you get from oral history, what I get more than anything else, is the detail. It's the richness of the texture. So often they get caught up with facts and dates. And I said, the names, and if you forget a name, you forget a date, we can look that up. It's not that we're advocating a post-factual world here, but we can look that up. So don't, and these people have worked with so many people, they can't remember all those names and things. But you want them to, you want to get them back to a place where they, where they, that was important to them.
Right. So I went to the website, and everyone else can go to a wonderful website, primarystages.com, and get a description of the project. What are the four central questions that you ask?
We begin basically with where did you grow up? The yeah. early, and we take them chronologically through their work. Where did you grow up? And the second period is basically your apprenticeship period or your education period, when you basically went from high school to college, and what that whole period was about, and moving to New York City, and what were your memories of first arriving in New York City and the first off-Broadway plays that you may have even seen before you even went to see plays off-Broadway. And then the fourth part is basically the career, and we jump all over the map
sure.
on that.
Right.
Question. And the fifth is where do you see the whole thing going?
Because the career would take people not only to some cases on Broadway, but to road companies and to regional theater and all the rest.
And movies.
And only, things. Yeah, that's
so
true.
Some of these people have done so much work, we have to keep going back to just to the off-Broadway
stuff. So you try to refocus.
So much. You do somebody like the designer Willa Kim. She was doing opera, dance, everything. So,
well, that's the other question I had. Besides, who do you not interview in this project? I mean, obviously, producers, actors, stagehands. I mean, is it any?
We haven't.
Or have you prioritized?
We've done restaurateurs. We've done group salespeople. We've done press agents, lawyers. We're open to it. We just want to make sure that they've been firmly steeped in off-Broadway, and that's been a major part of their life.
Right, right. Okay, so here's the question. You have, as we started out the interview, perhaps with the same kind of question that you ask when you're taking an oral history project, like, were you born into this? Were you born into this profession, or how did you get started? And then you've come to New York, and we talked at the beginning of the program about all of these fabulous playwrights that you've had the opportunity to not only work with, but advance the work of. So you're modest enough, I think, to say you don't know it all. No one possibly can. But you know a lot. So the question that I have is, of all the oral histories that you've taken thus far, what's the most exciting or the boldest or the most unexpected thing you heard that said, wow, I didn't know that?
Oh, that's a hard one, because then I start playing favorites, and I have favorite parts of all of them.
Well, we can start there.
I had one woman who came in, who Mary Claire Sharbo. She had 10 brilliant years as an actress, mostly at La Mama in the very, very early days. She got out of acting. She's an artist now. And she came in with a stack of pictures, showing me pictures, and she said, who am I? And she had a picture of herself in a play with Tom Horgan. She said, who's that playing in my husband? I said, I have no idea. She said, it's Harvey Milk. But who knew Harvey Milk was acting off-Broadway? But there he was.
Harvey Milk, the councilman in San Francisco, years later, who's become an icon in the gay rights movement.
Very good friend of Tom O'Horgan's. And she said, oh, he was working down on Wall Street, and he used to come and help us out, you know. And there he was, off-Broadway. There's been many wonderful surprises and little nuggets like that. And it's hard to put your finger on, but...
Right. In case you're just joining us, the program is Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer, and I'm talking to Casey Childs. Casey was the founder of Primary Stages, and he was artistic director and then executive producer of it for over 30 years. He's still on the board, of course, and now his attention is focused on Primary Stages' Off-Broadway Oral History Project, which we're talking about today. In terms of Off-Broadway, as a breeding ground, this is jumping ahead a little bit, as a breeding ground for playwrights. Do you think that's one of the functions?
Yes.
Okay. Nowadays, in terms of the pop culture, the primary, one could make the argument that the primary narrative vehicle is no longer the novel, it's no longer the motion picture, it's the cable television series. Okay. Putting aside a debate about that premise for the moment, do you think cable television advances writing on Off-Broadway, or do you think it cannibalizes it? In other words, if we didn't have cable television series, would more writers be sticking to writing for Off-Broadway theater?
Well, as Andre Bishop said, who we also interviewed at the Tony Awards, I guess last year, that this is the golden age of playwrights. And there are some days that we feel like we're just developing writers to have a good career in television. And you have to be respectful of that, because so often writers, in order to make a living and keep doing what they're doing, because there's not a lot of money in playwriting.
That's right. But there is a lot of money in cable television.
There's a lot of money in cable television. There's a lot of money in television. I've spent 30 years doing a parallel career in television while I ran a theater company, and it allowed me to have my art. So I don't turn my nose up at it.
Right.
But I do think that if you are a young writer starting out, that you owe it to yourself to, and you have the need to write plays. You really have to do that first for a good 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
You really should do that first. You've got to explore those themes. So often the idea is that they get swept up into television and they're off writing TV, and then they think, I'll come back and I'll write my play, and it just doesn't work that way. Whatever it was they had, they don't have anymore.
Right.
But I think there's a lot of good work on cable television, and I think there's a lot of people who are finding a way to balance those two careers now very nicely.
Mm-hmm. For someone who wants to go into the archives, I mean, can anyone come and listen to these oral histories, or are they podcast? Yes.
No.
No,
you can go at any time you want. It is primarystagesoffcenter.org.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a full website, and you can look at everybody we have there. We now have 125 interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, you click out of their page, and you can either click a highlight reel, which gives you 6 minutes of the interview, or you can click and you can watch the whole interview. Some of these interviews go on for 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
We just keep recording while the person is talking. So if they have more things they want to say, we just keep going.
So these are completely unedited?
Not completely unedited. We don't edit for entertainment value.
Right.
We only edit if the person calls the next day and says, I really shouldn't have said that about so-and-so, or I really... And then we do a little chop, but it's rough editing.
Sure.
Me, and you
sure.
can see what we just went and we chopped and we took out. They forgot a name and they're very embarrassed about it. We're not here to embarrass any of the people that we're interviewing. These are not exposés.
Right.
We want them to be happy with what we are putting online.
Right. Besides the archival purpose, I mean, do you think that the World Histories will have educational or instructional value?
Sure.
Yeah.
Our first audience are students.
Mm-hmm.
That's who, and theater historians, that's who we want to use this information.
Mm-hmm.
I think eventually I might be able to get, but I'm not doing this for that, for a series of TV episodes out of it, or maybe a small movie out of the interviews. But right now, we want it to be there for theater students and people interested in theater.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I should mention that Offscript program is sponsored by Johnny Cake Books, which happens to be a rare bookshop in Salisbury, Connecticut, which happens to be owned by its host, Dan Dwyer. So when you talk about archive, not only am I interested as a person who does radio interviews in the oral histories, but I'm also interested in real archival material, paper archival material. And I do have a modest collection of theater memorabilia on my own. But in the course of your interviews, I'm curious if somebody says, oh, and by the way, I've got a whole stack of photographs from that play that we did back in 1946. And you look at these, as you might in the course of the discussion, and say, oh, my Lord, these are incredible pictures. What do you then advise people to do? You're not in that business.
To deal with
right.
that. We do, sometimes they bring in pictures and we hold the picture up in a very rudimentary way and shoot it on camera and you mm-hmm. can see the picture. It's not very well shot, but okay. And we're not really set up to accept stuff, although we've had people come in with whole stacks of stuff. So, oh, great,
sure.
you can take it off my
yes,
computer.
Yes, exactly.
You can take it, but we're not a library. I wish we were, but we're not. And it's gotten very interesting now because we've moved into interviewing more designers. It wasn't that I guess I was delaying interviewing designers for quite a while because I didn't quite know how to approach it because the work of a designer is so much a visual work. It's looking at the visual archives of their work. And we're now finding the interviews are very interesting because they don't have the visual. We can't do anything with the pictures of their work. They've got to talk about the work, and they got to talk about their relationship with directors and things. So we've done some very good interviews with William Ivy Long, John Lee Beatty, Tony Walton, Willa Kim. We're doing Jennifer Tipton last week. We did Jane Greenwood a week ago. So we're catching up with designers now.
Okay, and what about sound designers?
Sound
technicians.
We haven't gotten into them yet.
But
we will.
You will.
Yeah,
great. What is the archival resource that you do direct people to? Is it the New York Public Library, the Lincoln Center Collection on... I know you don't have an institutional interest
yes,
in it.
Yes, we would send them to that, or we would send them to a university organization that's more equipped to accept that papers than we are.
Right. Let me ask some questions that if I were doing an oral history interview of you, inevitably I would have to ask, given the incredible group of playwrights that you worked with. And some of these you're going to say, that's an unfair question. But if you had to name one, or if you had to name several, playwrights, that without your intercession, without your effort, without your nurturing, otherwise would have perhaps been unknown to the New York theater world, to American theater audiences, who might they be?
Well, I like to think we had a big part of establishing David Ives' career when he started out. Well, he was a wildly talented guy, and somebody would have found him eventually, and he had had success at the Manhattan Punchline, and other theaters, but we started producing him very early on, and one of our largest hits was All in the Timing. And we've done 5 or 6 shows by David since then. Mm-hmm. So another playwright that I point to, although I'm not sure, we just kind of happened on him, was Connor McPherson, and we did the first Connor McPherson play in New York City. And that was before The Weir, although he was mostly known for The Weir. And that was looked upon as basically his premiere in New York, but I had come across a play about a year beforehand that called St. Nicholas with the actor Brian Cox in it, which they had done at the Shepherd's Bush in London, and thought, ooh, this is good stuff. This was about a theater critic who took up with vampires, a troupe of theatrical vampires, and we did it very successfully at the 45th Street Theater when we were still there on 45th Street between 8th and 9th.
Mm-hmm. How do you get your creative or your artistic instincts to lock into that? I mean, is it in your travel that you see other plays? Do you have informal friends and scouts abroad who would bring a play like this to your attention?
All come from a variety of different ways and sources. When you've been reading plays and around playwrights as long as I have, first it's just at the New Dramatist, and not just the member playwrights from the New Dramatist day, but all of the national people who would come in as guests of the New Dramatists. So I was starting with that, with a basis, which was very strong. And then it just leads to other theaters outside of New York, literary managers, other playwrights who bring new plays. So they come all different ways. We early on did more world premieres than we do now. And I reached the point where I said, I'm not sure I'm necessarily doing the best thing for the play by doing world premiere, because you put the play up, we used to put the play up, and the play was, the critical press would come and say, this is good, it was about 85% there, which was the reason you did the play to begin with, but then the play was kind of dead after that. And so now I try to encourage plays, and we try to encourage plays to have a few productions outside of town before they come in. We may be aware of them before they've even had a production. Sometimes we deliberately find another theater outside of town to do the play, so it can, because the play will just get better. It will get better through
Now, not to sound cliche, but what's coming through in this discussion we're having is that the play's the thing, obviously. Your focus is clearly on playwrights. You've made, this is not a criticism, but just reflecting on the conversation, you've made little mention of directors. And so my question, because I'm interested in directing and I'm looking at what's happening in theater these days, do you think we're moving into a stage, or do you think it's a fad or a fashion, where the director as auteur is prevailing over the playwright to the detriment of the vigor of the playwright's word and original work?
I don't.
And I'm not naming names, but you.
That goes in waves. I mean, sometimes you're going to find a very, very strong director who is going to outshine the play, and that's perhaps a good thing. There's all kinds of things that make up theater. But I don't think it's any different today than it was, has been in the past.
Well, then let me ask the question another way. Where do you think a director crosses the line between being reinterpretive of the nuances in the playwright's work and basically disregarding the playwright's intention?
It's a case-by-case question. The directors that we work with are there to work and to serve the playwright and to act as dramaturg and literary managers. There are plays that are so well-known. They are so well known to the audience that the director, director coming in and doing an auteur production might actually be very helpful in reinvigorating the audience's and the public's engagement with the play. I enjoy occasionally going to see Shakespeare, for example, in a far out production, because I know the play is a part of me to begin with. I bring all of that knowledge to it when I see it. And I would like to see somebody say, look, this is my approach. This is what the play means to me.
Right.
I'm looking right now. It's really not a director approach necessarily. It's a playwright's approach. We're doing the Pride and Prejudice. Well, Pride and Prejudice is a beloved book. It's a beloved book. And people, many of the audience that come to see this play, that book has been with them for many, many years, and it will be with them for many years
right.
beyond this. And this is one talented writer, mm-hmm. Kate Hamill, who is saying, okay, I love this material. Mm-hmm. What do I do with it?
Right.
What am I supposed to do with
right.
it? And she takes
does it marvelous out. Things with it. I'm glad you mentioned Kate Hamill's, Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. We've got to stop thinking of it as Kate Hamill's Pride and Prejudice
right.
because Kate and her husband, or not her husband, her companion, Jason O'Connell, were both guests on Off Script, and we had a two-part conversation about Pride and Prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Final word to you, for you, final question actually for you. In planning what you've got to accomplish still with the Primary Stages Oral History Project, how are you going about to planning the interview of you for this project, and who's going to do it?
Well, my interview cannot technically come for another 10 or so years, because
okay.
I hopefully still have a few more years in me to
I
talk
think so.
About it in an interview. I've got all of those people who started theaters at the same time that I did that we haven't even covered yet.
Okay.
So we usually like them to be a little bit further along in their lives and their careers. And where I am, I'm only 62. So.
Right, right. So there's a lot more stories to tell.
Yes.
Thank you, Casey Childs, for telling us a few of those stories today. The guest again has been Casey Childs, the founder of Primary Stages and now running the Primary Stages Off-Broadway Oral History Project. Thanks again, Casey, for joining us, and thanks for listening. The program's been Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. The program's underwritten by Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut. Until the next time, as a dear friend of mine used to say all the time, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.